All right, so today we're tackling a Supreme Court case that honestly throws a pretty big curveball into the world of conspiracy law. Imagine this. You agree to do something, and you know it's probably illegal, but T, the law actually says you specifically can't be punished for it. So could you still be convicted of conspiracy?
Yeah, that's the really fascinating scenario that the Supreme Court had to deal with back in 1932 in Gabbardi v. United States. And trust me, it still has lawyers talking, even today.
Let's rewind a bit, go back to the early 1900s. There was a lot of concern back then about what they called immoral behavior. And that led to the Mann Act in 1910, a law that was meant to stop the interstate trafficking of women for, well, let's just say unsavory purposes.
Yeah, the Mann Act was laser focused on those transporters, the people moving women across state lines for, as you said, those immoral purposes. But here's the catch. The law was oddly silent on whether the women themselves could be punished.
That's a pretty big omission, don't you think? It's like, it's almost asking for trouble. What happens if a woman willingly goes along with it? Does her consent somehow turn what seems like an individual act into a conspiracy?
And that's exactly the puzzle the Supreme Court had to solve in Gabbardi.
So let's dive into the facts of this case. We have Mr. Gabbardi and an unmarried woman who agree to travel together across state lines for, you guessed it, sexual activity. He's the one who buys the train tickets, they go on the trip, and bam, they're hit with a conspiracy charge for violating the Mann Act.
The thing that makes this case so interesting is that it was just Gabbardi and the woman. No one else involved, no big complicated plan or anything. The lower courts didn't hesitate to convict them, but then the case went to the Supreme Court, and that's where things took a turn.
Justice Harlan Fiske Stone wrote the majority opinion, and he really dug into the Mann Act. His argument was that the law's silence on punishing the woman wasn't a mistake, it was deliberate. Congress chose not to make her consent a crime.
Right, and Stone took it a step further. He brought in something called Wharton's Rule. This rule basically says that when a crime, by its very nature, needs two people to happen, like, say, price fixing, their agreement alone isn't enough to be considered a conspiracy. You need more than just the agreement. Since the Mann Act needs a woman's participation to even exist, Wharton's rule would suggest that conspiracy doesn't apply here.
Okay, so if I'm following you, it's like a law against, I don't know, selling concert tickets for way more than their face value. You wouldn't charge the person buying that overpriced ticket with conspiracy.
Right, that's a perfect example. The buyer has to be involved for that crime to happen, but they're not who the law is targeting. But there's an important detail here with how Wharton's rule plays out in Gabbardi. The woman can't just be going along for the ride. The court said she has to be the active or moving spirit, meaning she's planning the trip, getting the tickets, or doing other things to make it all happen. If she's just passively going along with it, then the conspiracy charge wouldn't stick.
And we can't forget Justice Benjamin Cardozo, who wrote a concurring opinion, really zeroing in on how involved the woman was. He argued that just her passive consent wouldn't be enough to get a conspiracy charge. There has to be something more active from her side.
And this is where Gabbardi starts to have some ripple effects that are still felt today. It set a precedent that's still debated when a law specifically says certain people, often victims, aren't going to be punished. It also protects them from conspiracy charges related to that law.
So even though Gabbardi was about a very specific situation with the Mann Act, it created a precedent that goes way beyond this single case.
Definitely. It gets to the core of how we understand the limits of conspiracy charges.
Hold on, wouldn't that mean someone could be involved in a crime but get away with it just because the law doesn't explicitly say they can be punished? Where do we draw the line?
Yeah, that's the tough question, isn't it? It's all about finding that balance between what the lawmakers wanted and making sure the law can handle new stuff that comes up. Gabbardi really throws a wrench into things.
It almost feels like it could lead to chaos. Are you saying criminals can just find loopholes and use those unclear parts of the law to get away with conspiracy?
Well, it's not that simple. Remember, Wharton's rule has specific conditions, and courts are still figuring out how to apply it, especially when you're talking about those really complex schemes with a lot of moving parts.
Okay, but if Gabbardi limits those conspiracy charges in some situations, how do we make sure the law can actually keep up with new types of crime, the kind that's always changing?
That's the core of this whole debate that Gabbardi started. Some legal experts say that if courts get too stuck on exactly what lawmakers intended, they might not be able to fight crime as effectively, especially when technology is changing things so fast.
So what you're saying is laws can't always keep up with the times, right? I mean, imagine trying to use laws written before the internet to deal with cybercrime.
Exactly. Think about hacking, stealing data, online fraud, all these things that might not fit neatly into those old legal categories. So the question is, should courts use conspiracy charges to fit those gaps, even if it means stretching what the law was originally meant to do?
But wouldn't that give prosecutors a lot of power? I mean, where's the line between interpretation and just overreaching?
That's the real issue. It's this careful balancing act. We want the law to be flexible enough to deal with new problems, but we also have to make sure courts don't go beyond their authority.
So let's try to connect this to a more modern example. Besides cybercrime, where else would we see Jabardi's logic in action today?
Take anti-drug laws, for instance. Usually those laws don't charge drug users with distribution conspiracy, even if they buy drugs from someone. It's kind of like Jabardi. The law knows the user has to be involved for the deal to happen, but that's not who the lawmakers wanted to punish.
So because they're often exempt from just simple possession, they're also protected from the conspiracy charge, even though they technically agreed to buy the drugs. That's interesting.
Yeah, that protection comes directly from what the lawmakers intended. They wanted to target the suppliers, the distributors, not the people struggling with addiction.
It's pretty amazing that a case from way back in the 1930s about something as specific as the Mann Act can still have such a huge impact on how our legal system works today. It seems like Gabardi really laid the groundwork for how we understand those silent parts of the law when it comes to conspiracy.
Definitely. It established a principle that people are still citing and debating in courtrooms all over the place. Jabardi forces us to think about a really basic question: who gets to decide what a crime is, and when can courts step in and broaden those definitions?
Right. If courts can just use conspiracy charges to fill in whatever they see as a gap in the law, it seems like they could create new crimes without any input from the people who make the laws.
Absolutely. That could upset the balance of power between different parts of the government.
It's like that saying, right? With great power comes great responsibility. Courts have a lot of power when it comes to interpreting the law, but Jabardi reminds us that they need to use that power carefully.
Well put. It's a constant balancing act, and Jabardi shows us just how complex these questions can be. You know, this case wasn't just about clearing up some legal principle. It also kicked off a debate that's still going strong, with people on both sides feeling very strongly about it.
Okay, now this is where it gets really interesting. Let's dive into that debate. Okay, So we've laid out how Jabardi set this precedent, but also started this whole debate. What are the two sides of that argument?
Well, you have some legal scholars who think Jabardi went too far in limiting when you can use conspiracy charges. They think that focusing so much on what the lawmakers intended could actually stop courts from dealing effectively with new kinds of criminal activity, things that are always evolving.
Yeah, I can see their point. What happens when criminals take advantage of loopholes in the law, or those gray areas that aren't so clear? Should the courts just throw up their hands and say, well, the lawmakers didn't specifically talk about this situation, so there's nothing we can do?
That's their argument in a nutshell. They're saying that with technology changing so fast and criminals coming up with new tricks all the time, courts need some flexibility to interpret and adapt the laws to keep up.
So what would that look like in real life? What kinds of scenarios are we talking about here?
Think about cybercrime. We have all these laws on the books that were written before the internet even existed. How are we supposed to apply those laws to things like hacking, data theft, online fraud, things that might not fit into those old legal boxes?
Right, you can't expect lawmakers to have predicted every single way that technology could be used for criminal purposes.
Exactly, and that's where this debate gets really interesting. Should courts be able to use conspiracy charges to tackle these new problems, even if it means stretching the original meaning of a law? Or do they have to stick strictly to the written word, even if it means some criminals might get away?
It's a tough one, no doubt. Both sides have good points. We don't want to give courts the power to criminalize just anything, especially when lawmakers haven't specifically made it illegal. But on the other hand, we don't want the law to be so inflexible that it can't keep up with new threats.
It's all about balance. Jabardi reminds us that this tension between how lawmakers intended a law to be used and how courts interpret it is a constant challenge.
So where does all of this leave us? What are the big takeaways from Jabardi that we should remember, especially when we're trying to understand its impact on the legal system today?
I think the most important thing to take away is that Jabardi forces us to see the limits of the law. Laws react to what's already happened. They're made to address specific problems at a particular time.
And as society changes, as we get new technologies, as criminals get smarter, those laws might not always be the perfect tool to deal with those challenges.
Right. And that's when the courts become so important. They have to interpret those laws, figure out how to apply them to new situations, and sometimes make really tough calls about when to push the boundaries and when to leave it to lawmakers.
Jabardi gives us a framework for making those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds us that courts have to enforce the law, but they also have to respect what the lawmakers intended and not go beyond their power.
And maybe most importantly, Jabardi makes us think critically about the law. It's not just some set of rules written in stone. It's a reflection of what society values, how things are changing, and that constant conversation about the balance between what individuals are free to do and keeping everyone safe.
It's really amazing that a case in the 1930s, based on a law as specific as the Mann Act, is still prompting these big conversations about what law is, the role of courts, and the challenges of working with a legal system that's always changing.
It really is. Jabardi v. United States might deal with events from a long time ago, but its central message about what lawmakers intend and the limits of conspiracy charges is something that goes beyond its time. It's a case that continues to shape how people think about and practice law even now.
Well, this has been a fascinating deep dive into legal history, looking at all the twists and turns of conspiracy law and that delicate balance between how courts interpret the law and what lawmakers want. Remember, even in a world where things are constantly changing and technology is always moving forward, some legal principles hold strong. So the next time you run into a legal debate about how far a law reaches or where the court's power ends, think back to the lessons of Jabardi. You might be surprised what insights you find.
Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp and never be afraid to question the boundaries of the law.
And always remember, sometimes the things that a law doesn't say can be the most important.